In addition, if there were the ability to create a federal law right with respect to these documents, I think the court can safely conclude that one was not created here. The second side letter was addressed to Emerald, even though Emerald at the July 28th hearing said, we don't want that, we're not asking for it, we don't think it's desirable or necessary. It was addressed to Emerald. It was not addressed to Rosemont, and Rosemont has not satisfactorily explained why under some federal common law of contracts here, if it existed, that they would be a third-party beneficiary of that letter or of the resolution, which essentially said that to the extent that the gaming board was able to do so for itself, not on behalf of the Attorney General, that it was going to try and waive the conditions of the prior letter. I want to emphasize that there is a strong reliance by the plaintiff in this case upon the language in that resolution that says that the Gaming Board wanted the first side letter amended to show that this waiver of conditions and that the terms were changed to reflect that it approved the new plan is the one under which the Gaming Board would operate to the extent of the Gaming Board's authority. All that approval language means is the same as what the Gaming Board had done before. It didn't mean that the Gaming Board was agreeing to be bound by the plan, assenting to the plan as a party to the plan. All it meant was, as the May 26th and 27th of 2004 minutes of the Gaming Board, which are included in the binder of materials we submitted to this court in response to the preliminary injunction motions, it's a tab 10. They're the same materials that were submitted to the district court. Those minutes show that Emerald's attorney said, you approved the prior plan as one that was satisfactory to you for purposes of entering into the first side letter outside the plan, as a side letter. We'd like you to look at the second plan and do the same thing. Approve it as something that was satisfactory for purposes of going forward with the suitability review, etc. By no stretch of the imagination can that be construed as an agreement by the Gaming Board to be a party to the plan. Otherwise, why would they be executing another side letter as opposed to seeking to intervene in the bankruptcy proceeding, becoming a party to the bankruptcy proceeding, filing a proof of claim or some such thing? Instead, they, and even in that letter itself, they indicated, we are outside the plan. We preserve our immunity from bankruptcy court jurisdiction.
So in a technical sense, is it your argument then that, let's say, the settlement, consent decree, plea bargain, whatever model that your opponents are urging on us as something that binds the Gaming Board to its the approval of its earlier members doesn't work here because the Gaming Board wasn't party? Because, of course, you know, entities of the state of Illinois with police powers enter binding agreements every day. You know, settlement agreements are binding, plea bargains are binding, you know, all kinds of things are binding that have police power overtones. So the question, in a sense, is why isn't this?
Well, it's not an appropriate analogy because, in part, it was the second side letter and the resolution were never blessed or approved or incorporated into a decree by the bankruptcy court. They were separate documents done unilaterally by the Gaming Board, which in the letter itself said, we disclaim any warranty of legal authority to do this. Remember, the first side letter not only it contained independent obligations by the Attorney General subject to the conditions therein, but it also created independent rights as a contractual matter by the Attorney General. And once the Attorney General, those conditions failed, the Attorney General had the independent contractual ability under the first side letter to go forward that the Gaming Board couldn't take away. And its disclaimer of authority was also, I think, sensible in light of clear Illinois constitutional law that the Attorney General in civil matters, when there's a dispute like this, has, in addition to whatever statutory rights it has an inalienable constitutional power to determine whether a proceeding should go forward, not to decide the outcome as the judge, but essentially as the prosecutor to push that matter. And so these disclaimers by the Gaming Board, I think, knock the props out of any claim that the second side letter was equivalent to some type of consent decree approved by a federal court judge and therefore within a federal court's power to enforce as a matter of federal law. There is no federal rule of decision here that gives to Rosemont any authority whatsoever to seek enforcement against the current members of the IGB, statements of intention or qualified representations made by prior members, either in connection with the testimony of the confirmation hearing or pursuant to the resolution issued in the second side letter authorized by that resolution that was delivered to Emerald Casino here. The notion that this falls within the in rem jurisdiction of the court or within the expansion of the bankruptcy court's powers as recognized in Katz is one, as I indicated, I do not believe that the court needs to decide or really should decide, but I think by way of comparison, if because that case is recent and there are no subsequent decisions by courts of appeals or any other federal court, as far as I've seen, expounding on its reach, The Hood in Katz cases dealt with specific code provisions dealing with the core elements of the bankruptcy process as described in Katz, which are marshaling and maintaining exclusive jurisdiction over the debtor's property.
Well, and isn't just that, I mean, I don't see why this is actually all that important an issue, frankly, because it seems to me whatever the license is was part of the bankruptcy
estate. I absolutely
now,
agree.
Now, it may be a big thing, it may be a nothing, you know, it may be somewhere, actually probably isn't anywhere in between. It's either everything or nothing. But, you know, Katz reinforces that it is, in fact, the thing with which
and we have no quarrel with that. We just think that it's clear that the bankruptcy court can't expand those property rights under the guise of declaring what they are, and especially when that would involve, as here, not just taking away, you know, sovereign immunity when the state acting as a creditor tries to invoke it, but here when the state is exercising its police power functions. Katz comes nowhere near reaching that type of nullification of state functions that the plaintiffs are seeking here. So I think to summarize, the claims in this case do not involve one in which the plan itself, as Judge Weedoff indicated, imposes any obligations whatsoever on the gaming board of the IGB. Rosemont has attempted to rely upon subsequent actions taken unilaterally at the 12th hour before the resignation of several members of the gaming board, disclaiming that they had any authority to bind the state. They purported to say, we're going to go forward with this suitability proceeding. They never actually made any binding promises as to the outcome of the proceeding, and I think it's clear that there's no federal law right here to require a subsequent gaming board with a new composition of its members to give up their police power functions. This was not a valid exercise by the state of Illinois through its proper officers to disown or give up its ability to exercise those functions. So I urge affirmance.
Thank you, Mr. Husick. How much time does Mr. Goroff have? You have 6 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honors. Mr. Husick and I agree on one thing, and that's that you don't need to reach the question of the state's sovereign immunity here, but we reach it for different reasons. We reach it because federal law compels the gaming board to have observed the plan and effectuate it, which they failed to do. Under 1141 of the Bankruptcy Code, there is no doubt that the state of Illinois was an entity acquiring property under the plan. It was getting several hundred million dollars. That didn't come as a surprise to it. It was something it bargained for. The phrase is any entity acquiring property may have the plan enforced against it. Moreover, under 1142B, it is clear that a court may enter an order, including an injunction, to enforce the consummation of a plan.
Right, but I take it from your briefs, you agreed that 1142 requires you to locate this right in the plan.
As we do, Your Honor.
I'm step at a time. You know, we need to find it in the plan before you have 1142B.
Absolutely. And the plan invests, because it's a federally confirmed order, invests federal content.
So if we thought, though, that the plan contained qualifications such that the Attorney General's power to go forward with this disciplinary proceeding were not impeded, 1142 wouldn't help you.
Right. That would be correct. But the Attorney General going forward may have been a risk the parties were aware of. It was what happened to the outcome. And the Gaming Board committed at the confirmation hearing that they had ultimate say and that they would agree to support the plan and that they could establish any penalty, and they believe the plan process better satisfied all of their police power obligations than did revocation.
But now you've lost me, because I don't see a moment at which the Gaming Board formally settles the disciplinary proceeding the way I would expect to see, for example, in a consent decree. I don't see any document or anything that says we're done with the disciplinary proceeding, you're off the hook, here's what we've, you know, here are the following stipulations.
It was a condition. 5.10 says that in exchange for the state payment, they will agree to proceed in accordance with, consistent with is the term that's used, Exhibit B, which is the December 2003 agreement.
Right, but it never happened because the conditions for Exhibit B failed.
No, those conditions failed.
Yes, they did. They failed.
Your Honor, those conditions failed before the plan ever was confirmed.
Right, so they were off the table. So that's all off the table, and then there's this new thing after the plan's confirmed that your opponents say, first of all, it's not an Exhibit C or anything. It didn't exist.
Conditions failing don't automatically destroy a contract, Your Honor. They have to be exercised, and they weren't exercised. They were waived under the Saverslack case, which they've never addressed.
But who has power to waive them?
The gaming board came in and said they have power to waive it.
And what if they're wrong?
Well, there's no evidence in the record they were wrong. And again, Your Honor's own King v. Walters decision says that heads of departments
in
Illinois...
It depends on the department. It depends on other, you know, broader issues, I think.
Again, look at the gaming board's brief here. At page 4, they say that the gaming board has authority to enforce revocation.
That doesn't necessarily mean that the attorney general has no role.
The attorney general's role is disputed as to whether she could cause the resumption of the litigation, but she couldn't address the penalty. The gaming board, the evidence is only clear that the gaming board made the decision as to that, and that if you look at the disclosure statement and you look at 5.10, they agreed to resolve that through a plan process.
But you're trying to freeze a gaming board, because of course in the end it is the gaming board that revoked this license, and until, you know, I sort of think of Yogi Berra, it ain't over till it's over. I mean, the gaming board never did go through the rest of the procedures, and you want to, like, take a moment in time, August or end of July, whichever you want to pick, and say at that moment the gaming board lost all power to take further action.
To take further action on the existing disciplinary proceeding, that is correct.
Why?
Other than as provided for in the plan.
Why?
Because it was a final...
The plan doesn't say that.
The plan says that they, in exchange for the payment, are to undertake suitability review and to stay the disciplinary proceeding while it's done.
But none of those things... The plan doesn't actually say that with respect to the later letter, which Judge St. Eve is concerned about.
The later letter repeats verbatim what's in Exhibit B. The only difference is it gets rid of the conditions that had been waived, Your Honor. Your Honor, the gaming board specifically said on the 28th at its formal meeting that it had waived these conditions, but that's a waiver that had taken place at the confirmation hearing.
Can I ask you just a one crazy side question? Is that garage just sitting there empty, or is Rosemont using it at all? Or?
The garage is, I believe, sitting there empty and depreciating as an asset, Your Honor. And, Your Honor, Rosemont is out more than $45 million for the construction.
How far is that garage from O'Hare?
I don't know that it's...
It couldn't be too far if it's in Rosemont. Is that actually within the city of Rosemont?
Sure, but it's a garage that was contractually given, you know, available for Emerald. So it's not that Rosemont freely may walk away.
What I don't get is why an asset, you know, if I built a house and I wanted to sell it to one person and they didn't want it, maybe I would sell it to a different person. Hard for me to see that Rosemont's out that much.
That's just out of pocket. Rosemont also has the rights under both the plan and Illinois law to be the home dock site. It has the right to tourism, economic development, and the like.
All that forward stuff. It's just that the garage is an asset, which you have. And if you're not using it, then you're not using it. But
well, it's an asset that has significantly depreciated during the... But it's an asset that was belonged to Emerald for purposes of its casino operation. And I don't know that Rosemont in bankruptcy can go ahead and disregard the plan it's itself committed to. Rosemont made compromises, as did other parties, as part of agreeing to the plan. I mean, Your Honor, what we have here is...
So who owns the garage, Emerald or Rosemont?
Rosemont. Well, I'm actually not certain who bears the formal title to the garage. Under the plan, the garage would be available for use in connection with Isle of Capri's operation. So it would be something available to Emerald's successor. But I don't know where title is vested at the moment. That's not an issue in our record. Your Honor, what you're hearing is awful public policy. The idea that the gaming board can come in, make repeated promises, make a final order, have a formal vote, have a binding resolution, and then simply walk away for its whim because you've never heard of a new police power reason, means that you could never bind a regulator to a plan. And that is simply not the law. It flips federalism on its head. In the Katz cases, and you have other cases that say even where there's a state police power interest, it is subordinate to federal law. And federal law here prevents forfeiture, allows for reorganization. You have a plan here that did so in a way that, that by admission, respected state police powers. On a motion to dismiss, there was simply no basis for the courts below to dismiss Rosemont's claim, and we ask that their decision be reversed. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Goroff. Indeed, our thanks to